3 with Roy E. Stockstill, Commander, United States Coast Guard, in Gainesville, Florida. It's now after 5 p.m. Wednesday, May 14th, 1975. And we're talking about the engine room and the telegraph system between the bridge and the engine room to control the engine speed. Now, as I understand it, the bridge can signal to the engine room. They want a third speed or whatever.
Say if they want to go from stop to one-third head, the man handling the engine room telegraphs on the bridge. Now, that's a telegraph located on the bridge that are directly connected by cable to a similar telegraph in the engine room. Now, if they want to go from stop to one-third ahead, he'd just shove that telegraph forward to one-third. And that would immediately register in the engine room telegraph ahead one-third. That'd tell them what to do. They had an answering telegraph down there.
Who would run that? One of the machinists?
The man down there. There was a man on there that would answer that. Put the engine room telegraph to one-third.
Okay.
And that would also tell them on the bridge that he got that signal and that they got it and knew what was doing. And his answering reply would go to a telegraph on the bridge matching
what
the arrow.
Called for.
What they called for.
Now, would he wait until they got to one-third before he'd answer, or would he answer?
He'd put it right on one-third, and they'd go right at it, and they'd watch the speed. They could tell by the speed, but it was just as fast as they could get it, matter of a few seconds.
I understand.
Now, connected with the telegraph in the engine room is also a telegraph to the fire room. To let them know what to do down there about supply of steam. Excuse me, I got to go to the bathroom. Would you like to?
Yeah, I'm going to join you, I think. On tape. Everybody thought Commander Stockstill was deceased, but he wasn't. That's all right. He wasn't deceased. Actually, what happened just after the war started, World War II, he was at Pearl Harbor, and they had put him on a Pan American airplane along with Admiral English, E-N-G-L-I-S-H, who was head of the anti-submarine war effort for the United States in the Pacific. And he was supposed to go back to San Francisco, but they would only allow him about 40 pounds of baggage, and he had 200 or 300 pounds of baggage because he'd been out in Honolulu for so many years. And so he found that he could get passage on one of the United Fruit Lines or American Fruit Lines something ships that was going back to San Francisco, which would arrive only a few hours after the airplane arrived. He'd leave 3 or 4 days later and 4 or 5 days later and arrive there just a few hours later. When he got in, he called up where he was supposed to report for duty about 4 in the afternoon. The airplane was supposed to have gotten there at 9:30. And they thought that he would, they were surprised to hear from him because they thought he was dead because the airplane had lost. It had come into San Francisco and the weather was bad, so it decided to go up to Clear Lake and land up at Clear Lake, but it ran into a mountain peak up there. They weren't found for a week or 10 days later. But this is where everybody in the Coast Guard got the idea that Commander Stockstill had been killed, but actually his report of his death was greatly exaggerated. And I just want to put that story in here while we're waiting for it. What was the name of that ship that you came back from Honolulu on in 1942 instead of taking that Pan American airplane that crashed?
Antigua.
Antigua, okay.
Now, don't you put any damn thing in that paper about that shipload of whiskey out there.
Oh, no, I wouldn't do that.
Because if anybody asked me about it, I swear it, I never saw you before in the day of my life, and it's over again.
Hear that, National Archives? All right, let's get back to
that. That was just somebody waxing facetiously, probably.
Listen, on this telegraph thing, I want to know the protocol. Now, the officer of the deck he's in command. He's the brains of the ship.
He handles the operations of that ship while he has his officer of the deck. He con the ship means he directs the movement of the engines, the rudders, and whatever else is taking on when they're at sea. Now, if they're at sea, they always got to be on the bridge. The con.
Wait, a question. Is there any reason the officer deck can leave the bridge?
Oh, no. When he's on that bridge, he stays there until he's relieved. Now, he can ask the executive officer to send somebody up to relieve him. Or he goes first to the commanding officer, sometimes the exec. And the exec can talk to the commanding officer. But the commanding officer's got to know who is conning that bridge every moment.
So if he slips and cuts himself and has to go to sick bay, first he gets relieved.
If he was injured for any reason, he cannot leave that bridge until he is properly relieved.
And the commanding officer must be notified that he has been relieved, and by whom?
By whom? When and by whom? And for what reason? And there's no deviation. That law is inflexible.
Now, the quartermaster is probably the man that does the signaling, or the messenger.
Well, he usually... he's not the man that usually does that. He does it sometimes. He'll be on the telegraph, but there's a man there that, for that purpose, maybe a yeoman or maybe someone else, but somebody qualified to do it, maybe. But somebody has what they call a bell sheet.
A bell sheet?
That's a sheet there that's used, got hours, time intervals on it. Start out at a certain time, and suppose one-third ahead. It's checked
is this
right
on the
on
bridge?
It. This is put on there by a person. It's not automatic.
Is it on the bridge, though?
It's on the bridge.
I see. Would this be called a rough log?
No, that's a rough log. It's where this stuff is written. Now, this bell sheet is a separate thing from the rough log. Now, rough log's what written in there in longhand with pencil.
You don't mean the smooth log?
The smooth log is a copy of the rough log written out in ink. Now, all this stuff has to be taken care of. And they all
the bell log means the bell of the telegraph.
Of the telegraph.
I see.
You get a bell there. What's the bell for? One-third ahead or two-thirds astern or full ahead, full astern, or whatever happens to be put on there. It's recorded on a sheet.
And the time that it's done.
The time to the second. And there's a man in a bell sheet that's down there in the engine room that also recorded.
Who keeps track of your clocks if they're synchronized?
Well, the quartermaster has charge of the clocks. And they're pretty darn close. Any discrepancy in between time, you got a radio time tick from Washington.
Okay.
That checks that. Now, of course, we had 3 chronometers on there before the time tick come up. But it originated back in the old days.
Carrying 3 chronometers back in 1937?
Yeah, there was 3.
They back in the chart room? Is that where they were?
They had a chronometer. Now, I don't think they had 3 of them.
I see. They'd gone away from that.
They'd gone away from that because the need for them was eliminated. Now, the reason that they had to have 3, there was no time tick. No time signal coming out from the Naval Observatory in Washington, D.C.
So if you had 2 and 1 went bad, which is the bad one?
If you had 2, you couldn't tell.
Yeah.
But if you had 3, 2 against 1.
Now you know which one's the bad one.
You know which one was haywire.
All right, now get back to downstairs now in the engine room, the telegraph thing. Now, who is down there watching that thing?
The engineer officer is there whenever we're getting underway or anchoring, entering or leaving port, or maneuvering at sea.
An officer? Or a gun, or a
the chief engineer officer.
Mr. Braswell or
Mr.
yourself?
And there's an engineer officer down there, maybe a commissioned officer, maybe a warrant officer. But there's always
there's
a chief,
officer on
a
watch.
Warrant officer there, or a chief warrant. There's only controls. There is a first class or chief petty officer, a chief machinist mate. That's there handling the controls. He can't
only a first class or a chief. And I'm talking back in the 30s.
Yeah.
We're allowed to actually control the engine.
You had people training there. Somebody may get killed in some engagement or through accident. You needed training people to keep as many who were as capable of understanding what they were doing.
Was there an officer on watch?
There was a commissioned officer on watch or a warrant officer on watch at all times.
How many engineering officers did you have?
Well, one now, there's a warrant officer, and they could be chief machinist mates.
Oh, chiefs could do it also then.
Chief machinist mates could take the watch.
I see.
Or a machinist mate first class
could be
on watch.
I see. So there wasn't always a commissioned officer on watch then?
Not at all times. But when they were entering port, leaving port, or running wherever the vessel was maneuvering, say as rescue work, or
coming up alongside another ship, or whatever.
Coming alongside another ship, or if for any reason you had to speak to some other, going through the Panama Canal, for instance, the engineer officer himself had to be in that engine room.
Was that up to the captain, or was that strict protocol throughout the Coast Guard?
That was mandatory by the regulations and by the commanding officer.
I see. So then as an engineering officer, you very seldom ever saw you go in or out of a port because you were always down at
hell no, you never saw it.
So,
leaving port or coming in. You were in that engine room.
Next thing he knew, you were at the dock. That's the engineering officer never knew anything about the harbor channel entrance or anything. He never
saw it.
He
had nothing to do to that. He had no reason for him to do it. His job was to turn that propeller either for going ahead or backing it up, going astern.
Okay.
And at what speed?
Now, who was the gentleman who answered the telegraph?
The man on the engine room telegraph on the bridge, he gave the officer of the deck, told him, say, all engines ahead, one third.
Okay.
He had put it on a telegraph. The man down in the engine room on answering
telegraph. Who is that man?
Now, he is a first class officer or maybe a machinist mate, second or third class.
Is he normally about the second man in command in the down?
No,
there?
No.
He could be anybody.
Anybody, just about it. But somebody from the machinery organization, engineer.
Do you have a name for him?
Telegraph operator.
The telegraph operator. You take the telegraph. That's the way you tell somebody to go on watch that.
Well, for getting underway and anchoring or coming into port, there's a station bell on a ship, a ship's organization, where they're on entering and leaving port. Every man had to occupy a place on deck if he was a seaman handling lines, or if he was a machinist mate or a fireman, he had to be in the fire.
Called that a station bill.
A station bill.
And he probably had a station bill that covered general quarters.
A station bill for general quarters.
For
collision, you're not on
it. You had a station bill.
Station bill for general quarters they had. And also for a condition prior to going in to battle condition.
How
preliminary.
Many station bills can you remember? I'm talking about the 30s now, prior to World War II.
You had a station bill for entering and leaving port. You had a station bill for general quarters. If you had abandoned ship drill, every man on that station bill had a position and a duty to perform. Every man's name was listed in there, who was to do what. And then the sub-organization of the members who that petty officer was responsible for, and what officer. Then, if you had general quarters, there was one condition there for that. And then during wartime, if you had to go into a situation preliminary to actual battle, ready for general quarters, you go to condition. Baker, Able, and so on.
Did you have a station bill for collision?
Absolutely.
All right. May I ask you another question about getting along the same line? The Itasca had no interphone system. I mean, had no speaker system like ships did in World War II.
Oh, yes. They had telephones and voice tubes.
Yes. But the voice tubes were from the bridge and were not...
Went to the engine room.
And to the radio room.
And to the radio room, there was telephone.
I'm talking voice
tubes. Let's say no. There was telephone and voice tubes from the bridge to the captain's cabin and to his emergency cabin first.
There was no voice tube to the captain's cabin, was there?
Yes.
Just to his emergency
forward
cabin.
Forward and aft.
Could it carry that far?
Oh, hell yes. You could put your voice down that tube and it would go a hell of a lot faster and further than you think it would.
Okay.
Now, there was also telephone there.
Okay.
Well, telephone might not be working, or some reason it was disabled, shot away, or through some any reason. You could call him in his emergency cabin or in his... Now, first, there was a tube there that which you could put your mouth up and heave in a big blow blast of air, and it would whistle.
Whistle what, at the other end?
At the other end.
Okay.
In the captain's cabin or in the emergency cabin?
Emergency cabin, captain cabin, radio room, and engine room.
Yeah.
Any place else?
There's some of it maybe in a wardroom. I mean, the executive officers.
Executive officer, maybe.
Okay.
But you had no loudspeaker system throughout the ship where you say, now hear this.
Yeah, it was later on. That was put in. I'm talking about now there was a PA system there where everything was put on a PA system, just like a public address system anywhere. Now hear this or whatever. Right.
But that's after about 1939 or so, isn't it?
Well, somewhere along there. We got the PA system.
Just about World War II or just
before. Well, I think this was before World War II that we put the PA
But system. Back in the 35, 36, 37 Itasca, there was no PA system then.
I think there was. I'm not sure. But now, I think that's right.
I think there was one.
I think there was a power amplifier system is what your public address system.
Public address system, yeah.
And
I've never heard
voice,
of one.
Voice.
Yeah.
Oh, you could get in there and talk, and it would go from a loudspeaker down here to captain's cabin or on the forecastle head.
But let's say for the moment, just in case we find out they didn't have one. I won't argue the point for the moment. But let's say that they didn't have the public address system working and you wanted to tell the crew something, the smoking lamp is out. How would you notify the entire ship that the smoking lamp is out without a public address system?
Word of mouth. You'd call somebody. You could call people on a telephone from the bridge, and in case the smoking lamp was out, that was something that would be on a PA system, and they'd put
but
it on.
They didn't have a PA system.
They could put it on a telephone. Say the smoking lamp, pipe, the smoking lamp is out.
Pipe. Now, how do we go about pipe?
Now, they had a bosun's pipe there, this old fashioned pipe. And they'd say, now here it is. And he'd pipe, the smoking lamp is out.
He would yell it then.
Yell it on the mess deck. And he'd go forward to the crew's quarter.
In other words, he was something like a town crier. He had
town
a message,
crier.
He'd go around, he'd blow it, and when he blew his bosun's pipe, everybody shut and listened.
And he may walk aft into the wardroom country. Would walk aft, and
the bosun was allowed in officer's country in a case like that?
Well, This may be the master at arms was the one who actually piped it. The master at arms.
He was
on the mess deck. Then the bosun's mate would pipe it on deck and aft.
I see.
But they'd pick up these signals, and the moment one of them heard the other man's pipe,
they'd pick it up.
But now if the man was on deck, it might be blowing a gale wind or something. They wouldn't hear it, but they'd get him on the phone, telephone. And it'd be...
Pipe the smoking lamp pipe, is out.
Smoking lamp is out.
And that's the way it was done in the early days, or in case of a failure of the...
And by day, smoking lamp was out. That flag was hoisted to the port port yard arm.
Even Baker?
Baker. Okay. And that lamp was out. It meant that you were taking on explosives or explosive. Maybe shells, powder.
Fuel,
gasoline. What
okay. I'm rushing because I have to, because I have to let you go. I want to ask you a couple other questions about the engine room. Oh, no, I've got that covered. Bosun's piping, I got that covered. See, I'm having trouble writing about... Can you suggest some books I might read that would help me? I know the Blue Jackets Manual of 1935 or something like that. Officer's Watch or something like that.
The Coast Guard has some magazine or book publications. And I think your best bet would be to write the Commandant of the Coast Guard. And you might go there to San Francisco.
Yeah, I can go right down to
their office and see their exec would be the proper one to see about it. You'd probably get
some. But I want to get some books that give me what a watch officer would do. And the
watch
officer is
what you want to call.
Not now, it's different.
A watch officer's guide.
Watch officer's guide, beautiful.
That's what you want
get
to
get one that was current of the 30s, and then I could write with some intelligence about what a man would do.
Then the thing, watch officer's guide, and among other things, seagoing terms, in his watch officer's guides, and then there's other books there on handling small boats, Coast Guard and Navy ships, but there's one on Coast Guard, seagoing terms, and the nomenclature of ships, and just the general atmosphere outlining the general meaning of words, terms, and terminology.
What did you find, how did you find the Itasca as a ship? Good ship, bad ship, indifferent ship. She was a nice ship, but she rolled all the time. It was a good ship, but
those ships were, they rolled a lot. Part of that rolled in a quartering sea. She was a bit uncomfortable, either in a head sea or a quartering sea.
Why in a head sea?
Well, it was light in the bow. Working around ships that where you're trying to rescue, and you may be up at the stern, probably have to pull somebody off at the stern. You want that ship light in the bow to keep the people that's on the bow from being washed overboard.
If the
ship goes in underneath the wave that's coming in there, you don't want to get your people overboard, certainly. Now, neither do you want the people that you're going to take off of some ship. You don't want them to get injured either. So, being light in the bow is the answer. And you've got to design it that way.
Okay. But mechanically, was there anything wrong with her?
No, of course.
She had plenty of power, plenty of electricity.
It had power for what it was designed for. Now, as to whether this long stack, there's a lot of us didn't care for that thing because it not only had a long stack, but it had tall masts. It was just single masts. And they put the crow's nests, must have been up in the clouds at the time. I think the damn crow's nest was, I don't know, it seems to me like it's impossible. 85 feet above the water, from the water line. I know one time I was going into San Francisco and I had the deck on. one of them, and the fog was, we started in, was a little down, further in we got to lower it down was, and they had to bring him, the man out of the crow's nest to get down, he was in the fog up there to get him down on the flying bridge where he could see something.
Well, how many men were normally on the bridge?
Well, let's see,
one,
two, three, four, five, six, about six, seven.
How was that?
Here, first off, you get commanding officers are going to be on a bridge entering or leaving port.
Okay.
Or when there's rescue work, he's got to be there. Sometimes the executive officer has to be on board, on a bridge. Off on the side is the navigator, because he's out there, he's got to be there to control whoever, what channel they go in, and so on. Now, the exec has the con of the ship when it's getting underway or coming in to anchor or moor, tie up alongside of a dock. The exec has the con of the vessel. Now, when the vessel is leaving port and he is going out, after he gets away from the immediate berthing area and gets squared away in the channel, the executive, being the navigator, may take it, but it's usually the officer, commissioned officer of the deck. But the navigator is still there. And after they get into the channel, why, the exec may go on below, but the commanding officer stays up there until after they get out and clear the channel. They're coming in, the operation...
Now how many, when you're out and clear the channel at sea, how many men are normally on watch up there?
Well, you'd have the officer of the deck,
right,
commissioned officer. There'll be a quartermaster, on there, and... On the lookout, there'd be a man there.
Right. When you say the lookout, you mean
in the crow's nest.
In the crow's nest.
Or if it's thick weather,
on the bow.
On the bow. Also in thick weather, there'd be one on the stern.
But normally only one in the crow's nest.
One in the crow's nest. Clear day. One in the crow's nest. The officer of the deck. The quartermaster on the bridge.
Was there usually a messenger on the bridge?
There's somebody there that usually ran messenger, but he usually was there at a particular time. Sometimes, maybe a man, a messenger from the radio shack would come in.
Now, where did that messenger hang out? Did he hang out on the bridge or in the radio shack? Or wasn't there normally three men on the bridge all the time?
Yes, there was about three men. There was a messenger up there.
The messenger's up there usually.
What
would happen when a radio message come in?
Well, a man received the message, and he types it out, and whoever, it went to the commanding officer, and he got it first.
But it went through the officer of the deck. I mean,
it would go to the officer of the deck.
So the radio man would press a button, and a messenger would come down the radio room to pick up that.
That's the way it
was operated.
Take
it to the officer of the deck. Officer deck would initial it, and then the officer deck would decide whether to wake the captain up or send the messenger down with it or file it till morning or whatever.
Disposition of it was immediate, though, unless there was some
standing order
to the contrary. The commanding officer, as soon as he got that, one of that message come in and went to the officer of the deck.
And the address to NRUI was addressed to the commanding officer, not to some officer of the deck.
It came to the ship.
And that was meant the commanding officer.
That meant the CO of that ship.
Okay, now I know I'm rushing like crazy, but I have to, because I've got to give you some time to get, you've got to give you the rest. The other thing, the man, look at that beautiful car. Look at that beautiful red. The man in the lookout, how would he notify the bridge, the man in the crow's nest? Or how would the man in the bow or the stern notify the bridge?
There were push buttons up there on a telephone. He pushed a button, the phone rang.
Well, the phone didn't work.
And
He had a voice tube.
Especially that man, it was, crow's there nest. Was a voice tube that came down.
I see.
He had whistled down there.
And did the bow and stern watch also have a voice tube?
Oh, yes, on that bridge.
Boy, there was a lot of voice tubes up that bridge, isn't there?
Listen, when you've got to have it...
You've
got to
have it. There's nothing more dependable than yelling.
And, of course, here later on, they got bullhorns.
Yeah.
Talk TBS. Talk between chips.
Can you remember, go back to going down to Samoa and whatnot. Can you remember